Welcome to International Clearance. Very happy to be back. Been watching a lot of football this week. It's been a lot of fun. There's been so much going on. I just feel like the storylines in football are just getting more and more entertaining, more ridiculous. So I'm back with my usual co-host, Joseph Walker. I gave you the full government this week.
Wow.
Feel like you deserved it.
Like my mum.
It's because the other famous Joseph dropped Diligent this week. So, you know, I feel like you deserve the Diligent intro, you know?
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Broseph Adenuga, as our good friend Chris has called me on a few occasions. Yeah, it's good to be back. AFCON's proven to be like one of the best tournaments of all time at current rate.
Mate, this AFCON tournament is at least the greatest AFCON tournament I've seen in my lifetime, which obviously there might have been better ones, but all I can say in the 3 decades I've managed to be alive, this is definitely up there.
Yeah, and what's also great about the AFCON is that there's big contributions from some of the players that we mentioned last week in that long readout of British-born or British-raised players that have nationalised or played for their families' countries. So we're going to have a talk about that a little bit later on. But before we do, we'll look at the club game and what some of our representatives and our good people out there are up to. We were hoping that Kieran Trippier was going to join Harry Kane and Eric Dier at Bayern Munich. That has not materialised. We said there was an issue between Bayern want a loan and want to pay money later. Newcastle will want money now. That just seemed to be a deal breaker. So that move is off. He's gone straight back into the Newcastle team. And I think everyone's just acting like that never happened. So onwards we march. Kieran Trippier remains at Newcastle United. Bayern, though, of course, does have a new English arrival, Eric Dier. And he made his first start for Bayern on the weekend just gone, 3-2 away win at Augsburg. We're not going to talk about this title race every week, although if Harry Kane keeps scoring, you know, it's going to get a good few
minutes. We're going to have to, yeah.
But it made me laugh. We were talking about how inevitable Bayern were. Then they lost almost like an hour after we recorded last week's episode. 2 games since then, and they've won them both. Leverkusen dropped points, so Bayern are back to being just 2 points behind Leverkusen, no game in hand. Harry Kane scored in that away win at Augsburg. And I want to note it because it was number 23 in the league for Kane this season. We are in January, Scully. 23 is actually the average league tally that Kane had over an entire season for Tottenham. So he's already at his yearly average for Tottenham in January, which means we could be seeing 30, maybe even 40 league goals from Harry Kane this season.
I reckon he's going to get the 40.
Like, this is crazy.
He's going to finish the Lewandowski comparisons. Like, it's over. Lewandowski's highest scoring season is 41. I just want to double check. I truly believe Harry Kane can get 46. It's done. It's over for Lewandowski, I'm afraid. Yeah. Count your days.
The goal was quite funny, actually. I don't know if you saw it. It was a tackle put him through on goal, and so everyone thought it was offside, but it was a tackle because he was basically a no man's land, but it was a very easy goal. But you take them all, you've got to be in the right places.
He loves
make
it,
your
man.
Own luck.
He loves it.
And he posted a picture with him and Eric Dier on the coach home after, like, he's very happy to have his mate there. Dier started at centre half immediately. And I looked at the team, it was like Afonso Davis left back, Dier, De Ligt, and not Guerrero.
Because they've just signed Sacha Boey. So it's obviously they want to get rid of the current right back.
Yeah, it is Guerrero.
Yeah, they've not been having a great time with their defence, to be honest.
Well, they've got half a dozen absentees, which is why they needed Dier. And that's why he's gone in straight away. Upamecano's not around. Kimmich isn't around. They needed him in straight away. And it's not a clean sheet, obviously. 2 goals at Augsburg. But
A win's a win.
We'll hop to Italy. Ruben Loftus-Cheek got a shout last week. He's scored twice against Bologna on the weekend. 4 in 4 for Milan. He hadn't scored 4 in his previous 135 career games. Is this purple patch stuff? Are we looking at someone just enjoying his football again? Because let's be honest, that 135 career games probably spanned over a lot of time between
five,
a lot of injuries.
Years. Yeah.
So,
a loss of trust. It was a Chelsea team that was wanting to overachieve and achieve quickly. obviously Ruben Loftus-Cheek is doing amazing at Milan. Yes, it's a different league. There's a lot more time and space, I think, for him. But certain players are also just built for those kind of conditions. There's a lot of English players that, yes, the Premier League is arguably the greatest league right now, but I would love you to go to another league and play in a place that would favour you. Like, I would have loved if, when his injury started to become more troubling, Jack Wilshere had gone to a Milan or somewhere where he could really enjoy his football, like you just said about RLC. So it's really nice to see players that you know are talented do this.
But that's 4-4, but 5 across the season for Loftus-Cheek. His season best for Chelsea was 6, so looking like good form. Broader question, speaking from an England standpoint, how good would Loftus-Cheek have to do for him to be back in contention as a midfield option? England's best players are all very, very good. Getting them on the pitch at the same time can be a bit of a challenge. And I think the depth in midfield is slightly exaggerated.
Do you know what the problem is? I think that we have a lot of good players, as you said, but it's difficult to play all the best players in their best positions. Because really and truly, we want Rice and Bellingham and Foden to play. But then that means Bellingham doesn't play how he plays at Real Madrid, which is essentially...
I don't like it.
I call him a false 10. Like, he's not even a 10. He's a second striker. He's a 10 that crashes into the box and scores goals, which means really and truly, you can't play Foden because Foden in the midfield wants to be a 10. So you have to play another more industrious type 8. Who that is going to be, I don't know. Grealish has been moved to the wing by Pep. And that is why RLC could be a cheeky shout to go and make it on the plane. When you put this in our notes and I was reading it, I was like, come off it, Joe. But thinking about it, it does make sense. Like, why not? You have Rice, you have RLC, then you have a Bellingham or a Foden up ahead. It makes sense. I wouldn't deny it.
Yeah, I guess the big thing against him, and I don't know, maybe this is assuming so much of Gareth Southgate, Fikayo Tomori...
Yes.
In his finest form with Milan, wasn't really getting a look in. He had to, and even when he does, he's still quite far down the pecking order, which probably gives you an indication of how much Southgate thinks of that level in Italy right now. So maybe Ruben Loftus-Cheek scoring 4-4 is just kind of, that's fine, but I'm going to need to see a hell of a lot more intensity and other things before you're back in the fold ahead of some of the other players, even if they're not playing like Calvin Phillips or somebody like that.
He's definitely taking Phillips and Gallagher, let's be real.
Elsewhere in Italy, Jed Spence made his debut for Genoa. You might have missed that move, some of you. That's a loan from Tottenham as part of the deal that got Dragosin to Tottenham from Genoa, the centre-back. I mean, he had a quiet spell at Rennes last season. Whenever certain players are in the spotlight, and I feel like Jed Spence is a name that his name rings louder bells than... certainly his on-pitch performances over the last 2 years. But I remember when he went to that loan deal in France, one of the appearances had a big video compilation of his highlights and all that. But I think he only played 8 league games in the end. Of course, he didn't play very much at all for Leeds at the start of this season. So just being on the pitch for Genoa to begin with is a great start.
Yeah. It's a great start. And I think he's one of those players who I personally want him to do well. I just feel like he's had a bit of a rum time of it because he went to Tottenham when they were under Conte. Conte just didn't fancy him. Probably feeling a bit sorry for himself. And I'm sure there's things that with his attitude, he can do better. I'm absolutely not denying that. There's always some accountability for yourself. But it would be good for him to just start playing some football, like you're saying.
Genoa is far away enough from everything that hopefully that benefits him a great deal. And then on the other side of that, we can maybe revisit and start talking about, is he levels enough? Is he?
Oh, 100%, 100%. Bro, eat your pasta in the mornings, chain it off, focus on the football, and let's see if you can get back to your best, because I don't like to see talent go to waste in young players, 100%. A part of it is definitely probably his attitude and his mental, but like you said, Genoa is far away. Just start playing games.
Yeah. Moving over to Spain quickly for someone we've not really spoken about. I think, again, missed his move on the hiatus. Kieran Tierney of Arsenal, he's been on loan at Real Sociedad, but he's been plagued by injuries. He was out for 2 months. I think he missed October and November with injury. He's been back since early December, and then last week picked up another injury, and he's looked to be out for a month or so.
I love Kieran Tierney's play. I think he's great. I think he's just a great fullback. but he is injury prone, especially in the Prem, and we're seeing that it's still affecting him in La Liga. He's got a consistent injury that keeps affecting him, and I really hope he gets over it and gets the best out of him, but he clearly couldn't regularly play in the Prem for us, for what we need in a fullback. He needs to get past this part of injury, and I hope he does quickly in this month so that he can contribute to their second half of the season and maybe stay there, maybe go to another team that really wants him, because he's somebody who I would love to see play week in, week out.
Yeah. They were fourth last season, Real Sociedad. Mm. Like, it would have still been a big coup getting him in, but the purpose would have been to, this is a signing that kicks us on, keeps us up really the top level of Spain. That being out for 3 months of a season is not ideal. And again, you look into the summer, Scotland are at the Euros. Although they are stacked on that left-hand side, you know, Scotland have made it work in a weird way. They kind of have him and Robertson together. They'll have one of them ahead of each other. They're going to want him fit for the Euros. Just because they have depth in that area of the pitch, they'd rather have him than not.
They always want to play both, but I do hope they are back in time, because Robertson himself is actually out for injury, but on the return.
And I think Hickey's injured as well, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so they need them all back, and hopefully... Oh, God. Hopefully there's not a further recurrences for Kieran Tierney. In terms of actual match day and fitness updates, we'll leave that there. We'll jump into, instead, some transfer bits. Firstly, I love this move. Reading have been in loads of financial troubles. It's well documented. Horrible situation going on there. They have sold their captain, who is 20-year-old Nelson Abbey, centre-back. Mm-hmm. He's left Reading to go to Olympiakos in the Greek top flight, which, you know, his head's held high. He knows that money is going to help keep things afloat for the next couple of months, hopefully, or at least for a small period of time. And then he gets to go and play for Olympiakos. He gets to go, like, maybe win trophies, play in Europe, you know?
It's great for him. He gets a lot of grilled octopus. You know, they say that if you win something at Olympiakos, you're a legend there for life. So hopefully, you know, he has a great time there.
Yeah, he joins, by the way, which I enjoy a lot. I don't know if it's a coincidence or what. Omar Richards at Olympiakos. Omar Richards was his Reading teammate about 2 years ago, who left to go to Bayern Munich. He was then sold back to Nottingham Forest when they got promoted, but he is currently on loan at Olympiakos. Olympiakos and Nottingham Forest have the same owners. So yeah, two former Reading teammates, both 25 and under, both defenders, are possibly going to be side by side for the remainder of the season at Olympiakos, which is...
I wonder if they're prepping him for... If he does well at Olympiakos, they say, we might need you, Forest.
Maybe. Olympiakos, you think about Greek giants and all that, they're fourth at the moment. That's not great. I mean, it is tight up there, but... Fourth in the league is generally unacceptable for an Olympiakos, but they are in the Conference League. So he's going to get some European football. The jump from Reading to Conference League, that's good fun when you're 20 years old.
He's going to enjoy that. He's definitely going to enjoy that.
So salute to him. One player that won't be leaving Britain for abroad by the looks of it, but I thought it was an interesting rumour anyway. Matt O'Reilly, take this in, Scully, 23 years old, born in Hounslow. But last year he made his Denmark debut, so he's very much in our territory. former Fulham, MK Dons, he's now at Celtic, but Brendan Rodgers has had to come out publicly and say he's had to fend off a bid from Atletico Madrid, who are, but if you're a Celtic player, as big as they are a club, that's a huge jump, not in atmosphere, but the level that Atletico are at, their ambitions and what they would like to do in Europe as well. I bet he's quietly hoping that Atletico up the bid. Brendan Rodgers insists he'll remain a Celtic player, will not be sold this month. So maybe it's one that is revisited in the summer. There's other interest here noted by Sky from Girona, who are top of La Liga, incredibly, and Inter Milan, who are second in Serie A. So very interesting. Atletico bid was a loan with an obligation to buy. Everyone's up to this now. No one wants to spend any money this window, Scully.
It's because everybody's still making up the COVID losses. So it's just full of absolute FFP avoidance, playing to the absolute letter of the law now.
You have to remove Chelsea's nonsensical shopping spree last January. Mm-hmm. And if you take them out, it's actually similar levels to last January. Clubs are just going, this doesn't make sense. We're not panicking. And we hope, how about we pay you when we know it's worked after 6 months? So Matt O'Riley, maybe it's the summer we have another look at that, but that would be very exciting. And supporting that, the idea of maybe Atletico don't want to spend any more money if they don't have to. And this circles back to right to the top of the show. So we were talking about Kieran Trippier. The reason Bayern were even in was because Newcastle, in order to meet for FFP and the sustainability measures, may have to offload some first team players. I think Atletico have smelt that. And so they put in a loan bid for Callum Wilson. That's the rumour going round anyway, widely reported. No word yet if it's been rejected or if it's actually even been placed yet.
He's another injury-prone player. He could do with getting out of where he keeps facing these injuries, playing somewhere else. Yes, Atletico is very intense, but I think being striker for Atletico is probably a little bit different because your main role is to just bang goals. Callum Wilson, I think, would do well at that. I believe they're going for the Copa del Rey. I'm pretty sure the final is like 3 weeks, but if you haven't won any trophies, ideal time to go. And yeah, you might play the final game, but at least you can be like, I was there. Winning trophies isn't everything for a footballer. That is 100% true. But I really dislike when people talk down the idea of winning trophies. Like for football, like you definitely want to do that. Yeah. Like you want to sit back and look at your career and be like, we won this. So if I'm Callum Wilson, I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I'll be real. It doesn't look like Newcastle are going to win a trophy this year. And I wouldn't say it matters for Newcastle because what's important is progress. But for himself at 31, why not go to Spain for a couple of months and try and get something over the line?
Yeah, I think his incentive to go is great. Have half a season out there, have a great time. But I do wonder whether they have the depth up front to let him go? Probably not. If they're saying they wanted money up front for Kieran Trippier instead of a loan, I imagine they'd say the same Newcastle to Atletico about Callum Wilson. If they said Callum Wilson was for sale, I feel like there's a couple of Premier League clubs that would bite massively. He's 30 plus million. He's 31 now, but people would pay him.
You would take him because he's scoring 15 goals. Like he's scoring 15 goals minimum a season, and a lot of people are not scoring 15 goals.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
That's one to keep an eye out on. Probably more concrete info between now and our next episode, because I think when this goes out, Scully, we're basically effectively at the close of the transfer window. So next week's episode,
The roundup is going to be sweet.
Yes, and we'll have some help to do it. We're going to have Cam back on. Cam, who runs English Players Abroad on social media. That's at English Abroad, the number one on Twitter. He's an incredible resource online. He's managed to be across so much of what's going on, and he's always got highlights where people are scoring goals. He doesn't seem, if the footage is out there, he gets it. He does not miss a trick. I mean, we're doing little kind of rundowns of transfer moves and transfer interest. There's a lot more comprehensive stuff. Kids moving to Brazil, people in Greece, people in Poland. He's got it all. There's loads that I haven't mentioned in the last week or so that are all there. And if you like the concept of this podcast, he's a must follow. So yeah, big up to him. He'll be on the show next week, helping us out with the highlights of certainly English players and their moves out of Britain over the weekend.
Shout out to English Players Abroad at English Abroad One on Twitter last time.
His website's also got a couple of interviews. He just interviewed a former Ipswich, West Brom, Chesterfield keeper, Adam Przybyszek. I hope I've said that right, pronounced that right, about spending the last 6 months in the Polish third tier. Stuff like that. So the kind of things we would be asking, he's also asking. So worth checking out. One non-transfer update, a player we mentioned last week, naturally feeds us into our next part. Ryan Gould, Scottish midfielder, having a great time at Vancouver Whitecaps, has been balling out in MLS. He's just signed a new contract there. Got that tip off from the Scots Abroad account. Again, another must follow. And the suggestion from John Walker that runs that account, it passes a milestone where he will then be able to be fast-tracked Ryan Gould for Canadian citizenship and therefore getting into the Canadian national team. Ryan Gould has never played for the Scottish senior side and has not been in the setup either for several years. I mean, Scotland are getting back into international tournaments now. So are Canada. Canada got to Qatar.
It's true.
If you can, Ryan, get involved.
Yeah, I think obviously he got compared to Messi, which is what killed him. But that means you can tell that his skill set is one suited to creativity and to making things happen. And I think that's going to be great for Canada if they nab him, because a lot of what they were doing last year, let's be real, was relying on Alphonso Davies. He was doing middle wing, whatever he wanted. So to have one extra player who can help you dictate the tempo and make things happen and play off of can bring you up literally just a little half a level. And more power to Canada if they get that.
We're all for players nationalising elsewhere. As you can tell, the expansion of our theme of the series anyway. So that is very exciting to see him on the international stage. And that kind of tees us up nicely for our international roundup in part two. Okay, cool. So we've been hyping up AFCON, but we did say last week, Chris Hughton, Forest Gate's own, in a bit of trouble. He's beyond trouble now. He's lost his job as Ghana manager. They needed a win against Mozambique. They need a better Egypt's result, I think. And they chucked their 2-goal lead against Mozambique, Ghana, so they're eliminated. You know, we mentioned last week that fans were going for Chris Hughton. By this elimination, the official media representatives were trying to storm the Ghanaian dressing room.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It looked all very January 6th, storm the capital, like... It was one of the most surreal thing I've ever witnessed. The live updates from the journalists saying, bring the players out, we just want to talk. I was confused. Yeah.
But yeah, that's Ghana out, Hughton gone not long after, real bad stuff. But their big rivals can think a little bit more positively. We're now into the knockout stages. Nigeria are one of the first teams to make it through to the quarterfinals. They beat Cameroon 2-0 and big diaspora contingent making themselves known, making their contribution. 2 goals in that game, both were from Ademola Lookman of Atalanta, but South East London. He was assisted by Calvin Bassey of Fulham in that game. Alex Iwobi did some good work in that game as well. They started slow. I think people wanted Osimhen to do well, who I did think played well, but isn't necessarily in the goals. They are in with a shout to win the tournament, aren't they, really? Of the big teams that haven't found some trouble, I think they're right up there.
It's a weird one because I don't feel like they've blown anyone out of the water. On paper, they 100% are one of the teams that you look at in this tournament and think, yeah, you could go on and win it. But they've just kind of like just plodded it along. And to your point, that's actually a really good thing. It might play in their favour because at the rate they're going, it feels like they're picking up and getting better and better. They have gone from like, maybe top 5 teams in the tournament to probably top 2. I see them doing very well.
Yeah, they've got Angola in the quarterfinals. I won't go into who else made it out of the groups because I think it might have expired by the time this episode comes out because all the knockouts are happening. But quite a lot of those names that we said are there from that big list last week are still in the tournament. And speaking of big lists, we didn't have time last week, so I thought I'd give it some space now. If we're going to do it for the AFCON, we should do it for the Asian Cup.
Of course.
Yeah, that's going
on.
It's
only right.
It's going on right now as well. And there are players at the Asian Cup who are of interest to us or certainly fall into our criteria. The Australia team has 3 Scottish-born players in Harry Souter of Leicester, Cameron Burgess of Ipswich, and Martin Boyle of Hibernian. Scotland and Australia have a really tight relationship. There's loads of Australian players and certainly Australian internationals playing in Scotland. And then you've also got players like Jason Cummings, who has moved to Australia, for example, and played and declared for them. So you've got those guys. You've also got Iraq. They've got Ali Al Hamadi up front, who moved to Liverpool at the breakout of the Iraq war. He's now AFC Wimbledon as a striker, although he is being linked with a move to Ipswich Town in this window. And speaking of Ipswich, Indonesia have one player of note, that Elkin Baggett, English father, Indonesian mother, and he moved to England when he was 9. Hong Kong, eliminated bottom of their group, have a player in Northern Premier League. His name's Sean Say, I thought I pronounced that right, born in Salford. And he has played out in South China and clubs like that, but he's currently at Radcliffe in the Northern Premier League. So he's back local.
He has a really interesting story in the academy for, I think it was City. And he trialed out for United and then going to play in China, not in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And they came back. It's just, I just think it's so fascinating. Like, I want to know so much more. We need to try and get them on the show.
Yeah. But on China, two players, Zhang Guangtai and Li Qi. Players you might not know by their names. But if I was to say to you, Ty Browning, that's the given name of Zhang Guangtai. Ty Browning, 29 years old, born in Liverpool, played for Everton, now plays for Shanghai Port. Grandfather on his mum's side was Cantonese. China have upped their kind of nationalization program with footballers. I think they've opened up the door a little bit. So it's certainly scaled up since 2019 where they focused in on it. Ty Browning, one of those players, he is now not just playing for China, he is in playing in China as well and has been there for a little while. And alongside him, Li Qi, as I said, also known as Nico Yanaris, born in Leytonstone to a Cypriot father and a Chinese mother, played one league game for Arsenal, Scully. I don't know if the name rang a bell.
He did. Do you know another reason why I know him? So yes, he played for Arsenal, but most importantly, he came from the prestigious Ridgeway Rovers.
Okay, so, Harry Kane team.
Yeah, yeah. If you know about Ridgeway Rovers, they're like they're from the East End. They've had Beckham, they've had Harry Kane, Andros Townsend, I think Dwight Gayle, and yeah, Nico Yanaris. So yeah, it's basically you've got insane pedigree if you come from there just off strength.
Maybe more known to people for his 150 games at Brentford, but he's played in Beijing for the last 5 years. Obviously, the crazy riches of the Chinese Super League, those days are long gone, but there's still a place out there for these players, and they've made themselves known. They've got local domestic names as well, and maybe we can get them on. China eliminated without scoring a goal at the tournament, so still lots to do. They have invested in football. It's taken a lot longer than they would have perhaps hoped. I think they went to the 2002 World Cup China, and that's probably it. And then equally you have a superpower like India, who also I think finished bottom of their group. They don't allow dual nationality, which prevents a lot of diaspora making a contribution to their international football progress. Mm. I mean, I follow the account Desi Ballers. I don't know if you do, Scully. And
yeah, I've seen it.
But there's actually been like quite a rising football league representation at the moment. I think Pakistan are the only one that really opens the door and does that properly. Be interested. Yeah. And until India do, I think they're not going to kick on anytime soon. So yeah, that's the Asian Cup, which still does have some examples of international clearance players. Not quite as many as AFCON, but still a lot there to talk about. Okay, this week's guest is from the northeast of England. If we're to actually map where all our guests so far have been from, you've got Peter Ramage, you've got David Priest, you've got Richard Offiong. At the top of my head, that's three. There may be more there. And now we have another Premier League player from the northeast, another former Newcastle player, a former Sunderland player, although his time there was quite controversial.
The Geordies love us, innit, in the northeast lot. Thank you.
If the most northern people are just open and friendly and welcoming.
Maybe if we ever do a live show or something like that, we've got to go to the northeast first. I think they deserve it.
Maybe so. Lee Clark played for Newcastle, played for Sunderland, played for Fulham. His management career has taken him to a few unusual places, even in the context of our show. So he broke out in management of a crazy unbeaten run at Huddersfield Town that eventually got promoted. There's spells at Kilmarnock, Burnham City, Blackpool, Bury, Blyth Spartans. His last three jobs have been in Sudan and Oman. Wow. Which obviously intrigued us. This is during our hiatus, and this is another one where it's just me. Sorry, Scully. But we spoke about him going to Sudan in the first series. We applauded him for doing it, and we're looking forward to him doing it. We're now going to get the roundup from the man himself about how it all went. Between now and when we did the last series, like even him starting at that Sudanese club, a lot's changed in the country of Sudan, which does come up in the interview and does affect his time there a little bit. So it's a lot to hear about from him, and we're going to get into it now. So here is our chat with Lee Clark. Lee Clark, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Great, Joe. Thanks for having us on. Delighted to be here.
No, thank you, and delighted to speak to you, because so far we've spoken to people who've worked in a lot of different places, but today we're talking about two countries that we're yet to really explore. So I'm really excited to get into that. But that's in management. Before we get to that, I just wanted to tick it off. So as a player, you pretty much have a sort of domestic-based career with Newcastle, Sunderland and Fulham. Was there any ever like an offer to play abroad? Was that ever likely?
Yeah, I had two opportunities. I had an opportunity to move to Spain in La Liga and an opportunity to move to the French top level as well. And also the opportunity to play for either of the Old Firm teams, but decided to stay in England. Probably the biggest regret is not taking up the offers either from Celtic or Rangers at the time. After being a manager and up there in Scotland with Kilmarnock and witnessed how big those clubs actually are, and the passion of those. I've been to a couple of Old Firm games, and the passion of those games, you know, would have loved to have tasted that as a player, but unfortunately, you know, I decided otherwise. And probably, so that's the only one where you think maybe I should have, you would have loved to have experienced that.
And do you think, having experienced that and come to that conclusion while at Killy, that you thought, do you know what, I would like to do a lot more coaching and management abroad if the opportunity arises?
No, it was always my plan at the start. I wanted to do some work in England, of course, and obviously in Scotland, but also overseas. And, you know, I mean, I went to two obscure outposts when I ended up doing it. But it was great experience and great knowledge and learning of obviously different cultures, etc. So, and handling of players and, you know, their day-to-day lives, their religion, etc. All these different facets that came into play.
Let's jump to that then. March 2021. I mean, we'll get to the idea that it's kind of, we're still in sort of pandemic mode and COVID protocols and all that, which I imagine had a huge effect on your time there too. But where's that connection made? Is it an agent? Is there a familiar face connection there in Amsterdam?
No, an agent who I'd had dealings with. He was based in the Midlands, and I had dealings with him when I was Birmingham City manager predominantly. And part of his company or the group he was working for had contacts and colleagues in the Middle East and stuff like that, in Africa, based in Egypt they were. And this opportunity arose for a head coach at Al Merrikh, who were a club that was going to be competing in the African Champions League. So when that was put to me, yeah, as you said, it was during COVID. It was when football was back and things were starting to come out of it, but there was still all the protocols and procedures. But I took up the challenge. I think the Champions League part of it was the bit that clinched it for us. It was really exciting. And got on an aeroplane and flew to Sudan.
Did you know at the time that you were the first ever Englishman to be coaching in that league?
No, I didn't know that actually until you just said it. So.
Well, that's certainly how it's been reported online. So yeah. I'm going to go with that. I trust their sources, but right. You know, quite a milestone, quite an interesting achievement.
Yeah, listen, it was a real eye opener. You know, the support was absolute crazy. We had a 50,000 seater stadium when we competed in the Champions League. We played Simba from Tanzania. We played Al Ahly, the big Egyptian club, who are the CAF and African Champions League equivalent to Real Madrid on how many times they've won it. They have a huge stadium in Cairo that gets 82,000 there. So on both occasions, when I managed on the two separate times I managed Al Merrikh, we drew Al Ahly in our Champions League group. So that was always a tough ask. And then obviously in the domestic stuff, our big rivals, Al Hilal, I managed one game against them in the league the first time round, and we went to their home and beat them for the first time for many, many years. So, and it showed me the passion for the game, the love that people have for those football clubs. And, you know, obviously I had the scenario of how the players with their lifestyles and their religions, how that affected preparations, the matches, et cetera, you know. So, you know, I had to take all this in on top of trying to win games and set programs for the training times, et cetera, the training schedules. And this was a big challenge, but one I was really enjoying. It was something different.
I've read somewhere, you know, the 6 a.m. training, was that as tough for you as it was for them, I suppose?
Yeah, during Ramadan, we had to do that. We trained at night and trained in the morning, obviously, and then the players slept, and, you know, and then when they broke up fast, when it went dark, the first thing we had to do was get some food into them and fluids. So, you know, we were in a training camp at the time in Cairo, so good, we were all together. And we could monitor the type of foods they were taking on board, etc. So, you know, but it was great. I followed that program as well. You know, I stuck to that, even though I could have, you know, with me being basically a bit of a tourist in Cairo and around the hotel, I could have ate whenever I really wanted, to be honest. But I wanted to experience that as well. And, it was great. It was the lads, we put together a great program. The lads responded well, and, it was really good.
You mentioned a couple of things already that I've kind of wanted to get into. So the rivalry between Al Merrikh and Al Hilal, even now, they're the only two teams to finish in the top two in Sudan since 99. It's only ever been those two one way or the other. So when it comes to actually you coming in, what is the situation there? Is there a specific remit? Is it, right, we want progress in the Champions League group? Is it, right, win the league? Do they give you like a list of priorities?
It's win the league. It's win your two games v Hilal, or certainly don't lose them.
Right.
And it's win the league. And my first time round, I took a lot of domestic games as well as Champions League games. But when I decided to leave, you know, with this situation I had with the first president I worked for, we were top of the table, so, you know, we were on course to win that league. Unfortunately, when they made the change, that didn't result in them keeping that top spot. Hilal win the league with Merrikh second. So, yeah, I mean, it's that, and it's, you know, can we do, you know, which would be a tough ask, and qualify from the group? Because, obviously, one of the lowest-ranked teams in the Champions League group stage. We hadn't even won the domestic league the season before, so we were probably the lowest ranked team and out of everybody. And then you get with a tough group that we had, but we put up great fights. We had some terrific games. We had a magnificent 2-2 draw to home to Al Ahly when we were 2-0 up, and we just ran out of a little bit of steam towards the end, and they kept pushing us, and we had two great games against them, really close fought. One, I think, was a 3-2 loss. And one was which was an end-to-end 2-0 down quickly. We got back to 2-2, and we were pushing for a third, and they hit us with a late winner. So yeah, we beat Hilal. Obviously, we won one and lost one in the group stage. But the loss in Sudan was we went down to 10 men just before half time. So it was always a tough battle for us. But it's some exciting games.
The fine margin seems so intense, like that first spell, the end of your first spell, as you said there, the season finishes, and I looked, they only lost two games in the league all season, and that's still not enough to win it, because that's just how unstoppable that particular rivalry is. But I just want to wind back to that first spell, in a particular this Champions League group. You've mentioned a couple of the sides you've played already. One of them was this Simba in Tanzania. Now, can you just play out this COVID situation that just seems to stink? I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but it's a challenging enough job going to play away games on the continent, but poof.
Yeah, so for Champions League games, we'll probably arrive 3 days before the actual game, so we can get acclimatised and get everything sorted and make sure that the training facility that we've picked and had picked for us is ready for in quality enough for us to train on, etc. So we had our COVID tests in Sudan. Everyone was clear, staff and players. So we flew to Tanzania. And what's meant to happen in the Champions League, when you arrive at the hotel, you're meant to get a CAF committee member with a CAF certified doctor at your hotel to just do the tests in your hotel. That didn't materialise, so we had to go to a clinic that was put forward to us in Tanzania for the testing, and then this is where the issue started to arise. Well, no, the first issue was that the doctor and the CAF committee member wasn't in the hotel. The second issue was we went to a local-based clinic And we were there for 4 to 5 hours, the full group, just hanging around for everyone to get tested. And it wasn't ideal, you know. We had prep time. The players needed to rest. We'd had a flight. So this was... But then we settled down. We had a couple of good days training. We prepped for the game. I'd picked the team. I'd done the work on the grass the day before the game with the team and the tactics of what we were going to do and how we felt Simba would come into the game. And my final meeting before we left the hotel the day of the game to go onto the bus to prepare, my medical team came in with the shock announcement that 9 of my starting 11 had tested positive for the COVID. Now, what flagged that up as well, what was another point out of that, was the head coach of Simba had been the head coach of Mereek before I took over.
Right.
So he knew the players, and he knew which important players were the real players that would make. So what I basically had to do, I couldn't pick 9. We had travelled with about 20, 22 players, but including in that party was players who were just coming back from injury. They hadn't played any competitive football, and they were probably going to be on the bench at best if they had done enough in the training. Some of them had come just to keep the squad together. You probably brought some young players for the experience. But then all of a sudden, some of them were thrown into the spotlight and having to be in the starting 11. And all this work that I'd done beforehand leading up to the game, our set police play instructions that we'd done, who was particularly marking who, and our corners and free kicks for. So with all that planning, it was quickly having to be changed. Now, it was right up until kickoff when I was still trying to obviously change things, because you're talking about 3 or 4 days preparation, then having to be redone again in the space of an hour and a half before kickoff. And then another thing, a red flag that flagged up, we had two players with the first name of Saif, and our main one of them was outstanding. We ended up selling him to a club in Egypt, and he was our main striker and he was our talisman. And thankfully he was one of the players who didn't get tested positive. But when the game kicked off, a CAF representative came to me and said, pointed at this CFL striker and said, he shouldn't be playing, he's tested positive. What he didn't know, and what the old head coach at Simba didn't know, we had two CFs in our squad. Gotcha. And the CF that was positive was someone who was just a squad player in anyway. So we played the game. The players done terrifically well. I think we ended up losing 2 or 3 nil, but you can't even say it was a patched-up team. It was just... As I said, we had two of the original starting 11 in the team. I think the goalkeeper and our striker, and the rest was square pegs and round holes, basically. So it was proven terrible, but the players had done terrifically well. I was really proud of their efforts. I was quite animated after the game. I was asking questions in my press conference. But then, obviously, the next morning, the players who tested positive couldn't fly back with us. But the next morning, they had a COVID test and they all passed.
All of them. Absolutely.
So it left a real bad taste in my mouth. And, you know, very, very questionable what happened on that day. Without any 100% evidence, I cannot say, but I'm 99.9% sure something untoward had happened.
Sure. And that's your third or fourth game into joining, isn't it? So that's just what a kind of awakening of what you could be up against.
Me as well. Trying to teach these people about how the outside world sees African football, etc. And I was saying, you've got so many positives to bring to world football, the passion of your fans. You know, you're walking around the streets and you're seeing kids playing on the streets, always kicking a ball. You know, everyone loves football, you know, and there's some really talented players. But there's always this reputation and this thought process that all things don't seem right in African football, if you know what I mean. Is there issues with, you know, sometimes referees or officials making the wrong, you know what I'm getting at? I used to say, you know, you've got a great product, but there's always that doubt in somebody's mind, and if you can clean that side of it up, you can be embraced by the rest of the football world, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned already that after a few months that you leave Al Mereek in the first spell. So you touched on it's more between you and that particular president at the time. So is that, you were happy to stay on at that point?
Well, at that point, the football side of it was going great in terms of my relationship with the players and the results. It was going great. But, you know, it just, there was too many incidents where, you know, promises were being broken. And, you know, I just felt that it was proving a lot more difficult than I wanted it to be. And especially when me and the president sat around the table earlier in the season and agreed on all these points, you know, and then obviously they did materialise. So I just thought, well, I'm on the other side of the world. I'm far away from my family. I'm going to do it if it's everything's aligned. And it wasn't, so I decided to come back to the UK.
Did you feel, due to the circumstances of that then, that you probably had unfinished business in terms of opportunities abroad, or may have been a factor in you coming back a little bit later down the line?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a huge factor when the opportunity came up for us to go back there a second time. It was totally in my mind, unfinished business. I met and spoke with the new president and the committee, and they were really positive. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get the right type of backing, and when something is said, we'll go ahead with it. And big plans for to redevelop the stadium, etc., and stuff like that. So yeah, I was excited the second time round, but a tough and exciting group where we, at one stage, we were leading the group, but then, you know, being pressurised and what happened is, majority of the time you have a sporting director and they deal with the incomings and outgoings to a certain degree, but then when they're like trying to get involved with the picking of the team, why isn't such and such not playing because he was his signing?
Right.
It became a regular thing, a debrief with the committee, and each one, if you can imagine, there's so many in the committee, each one has their own favourite player.
Sure.
And it just become very tedious, and it was getting us, got us angry, to be honest. So I think we had one Champions League game left before I just quit again, because I wasn't going to be, as I said, and this time was a little bit different as well, because we were based in Cairo, because of, there was a little bit of political unrest starting to happen in Sudan.
Right.
And the second time round, I didn't actually manage any domestic games. So I was based in Cairo and getting prepped, because we were using Al Ahly's stadium as our home ground for the Champions League as well. And we were progressing well. We had a great opportunity to progress through the group. But then things just started to unfold with the interference of the committee in what was being picked. I mean, I got criticised after our first game, and we got a real credible 0-0 draw against Malawi Sundowns, one of the South African powerhouses, who ended up going, I think they went to the semi-final. And I was, we in the debrief, there was a lot of criticism from the committee that we'd only drew 0-0. And I was like, whoa, hold on, we've drew against a very good side. So when it's like that, it's, okay, if you want things to be done a different way, I'll move on. You don't have to tell us. And that's what I did.
We'll get to that, the Sydney's conflict there. But I just want to quickly touch on, in between those two spells, there is a very brief stint in Oman with Al Ittihad. Now, this seems to be a much sort of different scale, one of only a handful of teams in the south of the country, all of which seem to share like one small stadium. What's the circumstances around this spell? There's a lot less of this. I was able to look up some of the results with Al Merrikh, for example, whereas this Al Ittihad, there was very little information I had on it. So what could you enlighten us about that?
Yeah, you're right. There's a south and a north. So my club was in a place called Salalah on the coast. Beautiful place. You know, I live right on the beach, or the stadium where we played, where, like you say, there was four or five clubs had our home games there. And then the other side of the country in the north, in Muscat, in the capital, would play the other games. And stadium's fantastic. Training facilities, top facilities, top class. But once again, there was just issues behind the scenes, like players and myself and my staff not getting paid salaries on time, not getting the amount of salaries that were agreed and signed upon, and it just become very, very difficult. And I'm just a man who's very honest, very genuine with everybody. And when it doesn't get replicated back, it makes us angry, gets us frustrated. And then obviously to top that off, I mean, we started well. We beat all our rivals. And we got to the semi-final of the King's Cup, which the club hadn't done for a long time. And we played quite poorly. And what I found is there was only a couple of teams where they were 100% full-time. My club, we had some overseas players who were full-time, but then the locals, they had other jobs as well, and right. found that difficult because that's affected the performances. And so, yeah, it was a beautiful place. I'd go back there tomorrow to go and visit, but the level of football and professionalism there is miles away from where I wanted to be. So a little quick little visit over there and then back again, you know.
There's a couple of mentions there across this, actually, about failed promises, over-familiarity, intervening when a little bit too much. Do you feel like those, they're almost trying to call your bluff or thinking you can't afford to leave this job or something like that? Like, they just don't expect someone in your position to go, actually, I shouldn't take this, but I'm not, so I'm going to go.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, it come across that way that, you know, previous coaches that they've had have must have allowed them to do this. And, yeah, I was always in the thought process, there's no way I'm going to be on the other side of the world to do something I'm loving. Granted, I love coaching and managing, but for people to interfere me, if I'm ever going to lose my job, it's going to be lost because I haven't done it right in my way. And
got to fall on your own sword, haven't you?
Of course. And when this doesn't happen, there's only one outcome for me, and that's the way it was on all three occasions. I never lost my job. I walked out of these places because of things that I felt wasn't acceptable and wasn't the way I'd done things.
You mentioned the kind of level of professionalism in Oman. Let's go back to Sudan then. That second spell was also just after AFCON, and I think it'd been the first time Sudan had qualified for a generation almost. What's their kind of standard of football that you saw in that country?
Yeah, listen, the top two teams, like you said, have the best players, of course. So there were some real good players, players that probably could come into Europe and make decent careers, without a doubt, and some very talented youngsters. Obviously, the grassroots facilities need improved a lot over there. That was one of the things I spoke about with the first president, about getting an academy up and running with the links I would have in the UK and around Europe, and start getting a real good facility that would benefit everybody. So, yeah, just there was some talent. There was some very talented players who could go on. Whether they had the fire in the belly or whether they could do match the professionalism, what it takes to be in the top leagues in Europe, that would be the question mark. But I think, yeah, there's definitely a lot of them with the talent to have gone, made that move, got some terrific contracts on the back of that, and went back to Sudan and made a great lifestyle for their families.
You mentioned already that in your second spell, there was no kind of league games to cover because conflict was going on in Sudan. That's obviously escalated hugely quite recently.
Yeah.
So you could really, it was already like at a boiling point.
Yeah, a little bit in the country. Yeah. We went back to obviously play Hilal in the group stage of the Champions League. And even though there wasn't, it's not as bad as it is now, where it's really bad. There was no, you know, fighting on the streets, but you could sense like the military presence quite over, because obviously I was based in Khartoum as well. So yeah, when I've seen the pictures the last few weeks and months, it's put it into perspective, because I've seen there was a building close to the hotel where I lived that had been bombed as well. So when that came up on the news, that was quite a bit of a worry in there, to think that I'd lived in there for a few months. So, and I can imagine how difficult it is when they're talking about people getting from one side of Khartoum to the other, to this airfield, to get airlifted out, because obviously the road structures and that are not like they are in the UK. And, you know, it takes quite a while to do a normal journey, really.
Yeah, that's actually something I think I saw in another interview you did, where you opted to get a driver just because it was, you just found it a bit too much.
Oh, yeah, there's no way I could have drove. I'm not sure they realised what the indicators were for on vehicles, but it was just like a free-for-all. It was a free-for-all, mate. And so there was no way I was getting behind a wheel. No chance.
So
if reflecting on it all, what would you say your top six for Sudan would be? So one apparently is get a driver.
Yeah.
Two is make sure you get up early in the mornings. How was the heat? How was the language barrier? What was that?
Oh, it was stifling, you know. I always remember the first time some of the weird pitches that we played on in the smaller clubs were like AstroTurf, but it was like the older type of AstroTurf. And it was that
hot as well.
My feet on the touchline hadn't even been running around, were burning. So the players were like needing cold and basically ice on their feet at half time and after the game. Obviously, had the situation where they need to pray as well six times a day. So during one of the CAF games, one of my first games, I came in at half time and was nobody in the dressing room, and all the lads were in the prayer room next door, you know. So there were things that I had to buy into. This was me coming into their home, their culture. So I had to, you know, respect that and respond to that in a manageable way and in a professional way. And so I was always respectful of their religion and what they had to do, and worked my football and my coaching around that.
Is the door still open for more things abroad?
Probably not, but hey, you mean no, football is probably the worst industry to say no.
Right.
Because you never say never. If you look at some of the older guys coming back to managing England now, it's at this moment in time, I've got no inclinations of going overseas, but you might call me up this time next week and I might be managing abroad.
Right. Well, that's the spirit. But is that much about you've had a go at it, you're happy that you did it, or is it being away from family seems like quite an ordeal?
Delighted I've done it. I'm absolutely delighted I've done it. For me personally, I'm delighted I've done it to go and see other continents like Africa, how they do things in the football world. Obviously learn about religion and stuff like that, and how you manage professional sports people around that. As I said, went to a beautiful country, Oman, and had a great few months in terms of my lifestyle there. No regrets at all on those decisions. And as I said, it was always at the start of my coaching career, was always something I wanted to do in any way.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for providing insight on those experiences for us, Lee. Lee Clark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. All the best.
That was Joe having a chat with Lee Clark. An incredible story to move from the northeast to Sudan. So basically to the northeast of Africa, like from the northeast of England. A lot of the listeners may be aware Sudan right now is under a massive humanitarian crisis. It's been going through a lot since the Darfur crisis in 2003, but it is been intensified over the last few years due to civil war between, you know, government entities and militias that kind of want to create a coup and take over the country and change things. So there's a lot going on in Sudan. It's important that we shine a light on it. And if you know any ways in which we can help, let us know. We'll try and let you know. But just be aware of what's going on in the world. And big up Lee Clark for supporting Sudan, I guess, in his own little football-based way.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about his story is that in the case of all three situations, he was able to walk away when he didn't like the setup of things or felt like it wasn't the job he thought he was walking into. Because I think a lot of people in his position are still trying to kind of make the best of things. And that traps people in some of these moves. It's the perilous bit of certain situations that aren't well-trodden paths. Often that comes with unreliable finances, volatile ownerships. There's a version of that where he's a young, inexperienced manager and just sticks it out because he's worried he hasn't got another option. And then there's options like he has where he's gone, no, they've not been honest with me. I'll walk. Really interesting. And yeah, appreciate his time. He's not gone back into management since that second spell at Al Merrikh, which was coming up 18 months, 2 years ago now. But as he said at the end of the day, never say never. And if he does, we'll be sure to let you know. So yeah, thank you, Lee Clark. Before we go, Scully, how can people get in touch? People have been getting in touch. I've appreciated it. We had some Spotify messages and comments. There's been some people leaving nice reviews on Apple Podcasts as well.
Find us at intlclearance@gmail.com. I'm going to say it one more time. intlclearance intlclearance@gmail.com. And we're also at intlclearance on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. Please let us know your thoughts. Please like, share, review, subscribe, all the good things to help us attack the algorithm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of this stuff. Just keep it going, man. We're trying to build something beautiful for you guys.
Yep. Appreciate your ears. Appreciate your time. We'll be back next week with a transfer window roundup from Cam of English Players Abroad. But for now, I've been Joe Walker.
And I've been Scully.
And that was International Clearance. See you later.